The year the world went mad, Spiked's book on 2020 is now back on sale for one final run. Covering everything from COVID to cancel culture, it's an essential, sparky, insightful guide to this most maddening of years. Get your copy now for just $14.99 at spiked-online.com/book.
Hello there and welcome to Culture Wars with Andrew Doyle. Today, my guest is Peter Boghossian. Peter is an academic with an extensive publication record across multiple domains of thought. His most recent book is How to Have Impossible Conversations, a very practical guide, which he wrote in collaboration with James Lindsay. I reviewed it for Spiked. It really is a fantastic book. You should check it out. And today, Peter and I were discussing the legitimation crisis. If you haven't heard of that, don't worry about it. You'll understand by the end of the podcast. So, here we go. This is Culture Wars with me, Andrew Doyle, and Peter Boghossian. So, Peter, for a long time now, you've been talking about what is called the legitimation crisis. And you've been saying that this is one of these things that is very, very important, but people aren't paying enough attention to. I imagine a lot of the people listening to this won't even know what a legitimation crisis is. So do you want to just talk that through and tell us what it is and why it's so important?
Sure. I'll give you a little history of it and talk about why it's important. I'll give you some examples too. Basically, it's the idea that there's a lack of trust in our public institutions and that there's an erosion of confidence in our institutions. Habermas popularized the idea with a book. He's a German philosopher in 1973 that with the name Legitimation Crisis. He got that idea from other philosophers like Julian Bender, a French philosopher who published something in, I think, 1927, The Treason of the Intellectuals, or the Treason of the Clerics. I can talk a little bit about Habermas if you're interested, but I've used the Habermas as a jumping off point to talk about it more broadly. What does it mean when people lose confidence in their institutions, their governmental, political institutions?
And do you mean academic institutions as well?
100%. Yeah. I'll give you some examples of this to help make it more clear.
Yeah.
But it's like you're sitting in a tree and someone says to you, well, where are the leaves? There are so many examples of this, the lack of, what does it mean to have a lack of trust in our public institutions?
Can you maybe explain why it's important, particularly when it comes to universities? Because I imagine a lot of people will be thinking, well, I know that these academics, they're these elitist people in their ivory towers, and they go on about stuff that we don't understand. Does it really matter if I don't really trust them, or I don't think they're talking sense?
Well, the universities are the engines of knowledge production. Let me just give you one example. So I know that my friend Matt Ridley, also on your island, has some differences of opinion about this, but global climate change and whether or not it's anthropogenic or the degree to which humans contribute to that is, I think, among one of the most important issues we currently face. If people don't trust the academy, if they don't trust the research, if they say, which I have heard repeatedly, oh, those are all liberals, or oh, those are all people on the left or the far left, then they're not going to trust the research coming out of the institutions. If our institutions, particularly our academic institutions, and I'll give you a great example of this, is, you know, on June 4th, 2020, about 1,200 public health experts, I don't know how familiar you are with this, but they signed a letter saying that protests were vital to the national public health and to the threatened health specifically of Black people in the United States. So, for example, basically you can just choose the public health school of your choice, but Harvard's T.H. Chan School would be a great example of this. They declared racism a public health crisis. So they institute lockdowns, but not for tens of thousands of people who protest for political causes. So they selectively apply the rules. The CDC in this country does the same thing. That's an example of obliterating legitimacy. But in our academic institutions now, and you and I have spoken about this before, people simply do not trust the claims coming out of the institution because they've manufactured their own body of literature.
I think what they don't trust, or what a lot of people don't trust, is the political partisanship of many of people within academia, which means that the things that they are claiming are driven by a kind of wishful thinking along the lines of their own political or ideological worldviews.
That is 100% accurate. They've manufactured reality. And I think a really important way to think about this is activists think that if you gain, this is all Foucault, activists think that if you gain power, you have legitimacy.
Yes.
There's a substructure to legitimacy, and that's about not getting things wrong, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not just about names and brand and image. For these folks, it's all about power. So for Foucault, legitimacy comes through the power of, you know, the authentication of truth.
Yes.
But the woke believe, it's like the Catholic Church, right? The woke believe that once they gain dominance in every regard, they can determine what's considered true or false.
Right.
But that legitimacy doesn't come from claiming it. It comes from showing it.
Well, isn't the problem here, and this reminds me of an article I read about by Camille Paglia many years ago, back in the 90s, an article called Junk Bonds and Corporate Raiders, Academe in the Hour of the Wolf. And what she's talking about there is the way in which shoddy academics are quoting each other endlessly to give this illusion that what they have created is true and the points that they have promoted, largely post-Foucauldian academics. And I think this relates to what you're saying, because really what you're talking about is idea laundering, which is something I've heard you talk about before. Can you define idea laundering or explain how it might work so that people understand what that means?
Sure. I also think that this is an incredibly important idea that more people need to understand.
Yeah.
So this is the mechanism for how many folks in the academy fabricate or they discharge their moral impulses.
So give us an example.
Okay. So here's what happens. So you and I have some idea. We're academics. We have some idea.
Yeah.
And usually it's a moral idea, but it doesn't have to be a moral idea. Mm-hmm. So what we do is we start a journal, we get a reviewer, we go through the same process that other journals, for example, in the STEM fields go through.
Yes.
And it's called idea laundering because it goes in one side as an idea and it comes out knowledge. So we go through the process of publishing that in a peer-reviewed journal, which we ourselves have made, and it comes out as a claim to knowledge. Other people then publish in this journal and other similar journals, and they cite that work, and then it becomes part of a body of knowledge, a corpus of literature that people then refer to. So when you say, well, how do you know something? They point to an example in bogus journals that they have idea laundered.
Which is similar to what Camille Paglia was saying, is that people just quoting each other creates this illusion that there is something there, there's some substance there, but actually it's just people in the same gang reinforcing the illusion that they created in the first place.
Yes, it's a collective participation in make-believe land.
So would an example of this be something like fat studies, which is a very recent subject? And people will think I'm making a joke there, won't they, when I say fat studies? And it's not a joke. What is fat studies?
That is a great question. Fat is an actual journal. And I just want to say, I don't want any of your listeners to believe anything you or I say. Look it up for yourself. There's an actual journal, and we published a Sokol-style paper in this journal called Fat Studies. And Fat Studies doesn't do what people think it does, look at A1Cs, you know, the amount of sugar in the blood over a three-month period, or talk about what macronutrient breakdown people should eat, how much exercise should. But Fat Studies is a journal that seeks to normalize being fat. And they look at fat, again, this is a postmodern notion that obesity is just one narrative. It's just a story we tell ourselves. This also relates to the legitimation crisis. It's just a story we tell ourselves. So Fat Studies doesn't do what people think it does. In fact, it seeks to normalize being fat.
And indeed to promote the idea that there is no identifiable health risk to being overweight.
That's correct. And they draw, it's Charlotte Cooper's journal and notions, and they draw from these ideas called Healthy at Any Size, which also has a body of literature to it that's been idea laundered.
I've seen this an awful lot. I've seen people attacking, for instance, cancer research charities who point out that obesity is the second highest cause of cancer, and saying that what these people are doing is fat shaming. And actually, we're going to point to this body of work that says there is no inherent danger in obesity. And in fact, it's more dangerous to shame people for their obesity. And therefore, there's a real tangible danger to that, because once people start dying, you know, that's not something you can theorize away.
That's correct. And so that's an example of a very slim example, I was trying to make a pun, of how...
It was good. It worked.
Thank you. Thank you. of how fat studies through idea laundering contributes to the crisis of legitimacy in our institutions. And these are college classes that are taught to kids, or in some cases, they have their own classes. My university had one, I think, a while ago, in which people either take an entire class or they have bits and pieces of their class in their gender studies or any of their broadly grievance studies related things. But fat studies is just one example among many.
Yes.
Of the legitimation crisis and people not trusting what comes out of their institutions. And the nucleation point, the center for this, is academic institutions.
Just the fact that I think most people would think it was a joke that we're talking about fat studies in itself points to this legitimation crisis, because people are just going to laugh at academics. And where does it come from? Why would you want to fabricate a version of reality? What is the impulse behind that, do you think?
Well, I think it's the idea that teaching is a political act. And
okay,
this is a very complicated question because it deals with people's sense of identity, morality, sense of what's right and what's wrong, and how they navigate reality. Mm-hmm. So that truth only comes from people saying what's true or not, as opposed to something that's actually true. So many of the people who traffic in this nonsense are themselves indoctrinated by postmodern concepts. And Helen Pluckrose and James Lindsay talk about that extensively in Cynical Theories. And Douglas Murray talks about that in his book as well. And the key to understanding this is that their moral minds are overriding their rational minds, and they've been indoctrinated into a system. And it's a kind of scholarship activism.
Yes, I think Helen and James talk about this in terms of applied postmodernism, as in the idea that the early postmodernists and the French postmodernists of the 1960s weren't interested. They were theorizing. They were talking about ideas. They weren't interested in applying these as policy to society. But then this activist turn happens in the, what do they say, 1989, I think they pinpoint it,
right,
as when all of a sudden academics start seeing themselves as activists, and actually what their role is not to test reality or to interrogate reality, but rather to form reality and shape society according to their ideology. Have I got that right?
That's correct. And so truth, then, you need to look at this through the lens of power.
Yes.
And once you understand that what's really operating here is the attempt to gain dominance over systems and institutions, and then they can fabricate their own, or not even fabricate, they can push a particular narrative, which is fabrication, although they won't call it fabrication.
So this is a very important issue, I think, in relation to power, insofar as, I mean, I've read an awful lot of the postmodern writings, and power is such an obsession to them, to the extent that I think they can only understand the world through power structures. And of course, power is important, and no one denies it, but it's not everything. And if you can only see art, for instance, let's take visual art. If you can only see a work of art as being a manifestation of the will to power, of one group trying to dominate over another group in a particular way, then you are no longer susceptible to beauty or the function of art. I would go so far as to say you're not really qualified to talk about it. And yet that seems to me to be the driving force between so many academics that I encounter on this subject.
I think that's right. I think if you really think about it, so I'm 54, and when I was a kid, I was taught civics, I was taught geography, we stood for the flag. You can like those things or not like them. That's not the point.
Yes.
The point is that today children are taught something very different. They're taught to seek grievances. They're taught a very, very different history of the United States than I was taught. We were taught about blemishes, but this education focuses entirely on blemishes. So let's take a pause on this and just reflect for a second. Mm-hmm. And we can look at organizations like the Southern Poverty Law Center and the ACLU to give paradigmatic examples of this.
Yes.
So the organizations remained the same, but the people occupying the organizations changed in their value system, in their value structure.
Right.
Is that clear so far?
That's very clear. And just to specify, so that if people aren't familiar, so the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, they were famous for instance, standing up for the rights of neo-Nazis in Skokie in Chicago in 1977 to March. They were saying that they should have the right, even though we despise their views. We must protect their constitutional freedoms because free speech is an indivisible liberty and it's for everyone. Now, fast forward 40 years. I noticed the other week, and I think I saw you tweeting about this, that a senior member of the ACLU is talking about how he believes that Abigail Schreier's new book should be banned. He says stopping that's the circulation correct. Of the book is 100% the hill I will die on. That's what he says.
That's absolutely correct. Chase Strangio, and he was consistently, right. So, okay, so let's slow down because this is so important. I mean, even in 2018, the Wall Street Journal leaked a memo about the ACLU's procedures on taking speech cases, right? So the organization is the same, but the people who occupied that come from a different value set. So when that memo was leaked, it said that speech had to be considered in the context of the, quote, potential effect on marginalized communities. I believe that's the exact quotation.
Right, which is not compatible with the original stance of the ACLU back in the 70s.
Okay, so which is not compatible with the way that the ACLU discharged its mission, but the people occupying those institutions is very different. And I think that my response to his, this is the hill, Abigail Schreier's book should be banned, making people not trans. And I've read the book and that's just not true. It's, but again, we can talk about this. I think I tweeted out, let's see if I can have my tweet is something like, Fred is a cop and a member of the KKK, but that doesn't influence his policing behavior, nor does he speak for the police when he's cross-burning.
Right.
So you have people occupying the institutions. That would never be the case now that they would allow Nazis to protest or neo-Nazis to protest in Skokie.
No, it wouldn't be, would it? I mean, it's sort of like you're dealing with two completely different organizations at this point. I think people will be confused as to how that has happened. I know that Glenn Greenwald has recently written about this interior conflict in the ACLU between the old school sort of liberal mindset that says, you know, free speech is for everyone, and a new generation that says that actually words are violence, words are power. In other words, those who are informed, whether they've read it or not, by the postmodernist mindset.
That's correct. And you don't have to stop at the ACLU. You know, 2016, the SPLC published its field guide to anti-Muslim extremists that put Majid Nawaz and the Quilliam Foundation on that list.
I mean, that's insane. Majid Nawaz is a Muslim. And to see him as Islamophobic is insane, I think.
Right. So that's the whole problem. I mean, this is such a profound issue that I predict within the next few months, 6 months max, that this is going to take off. And this is really what people are going to be talking about almost exclusively.
You're listening to Culture Wars with Andrew Doyle. If you're enjoying the podcast, please make sure you subscribe so you never miss an episode. You can subscribe to the podcast on all the major apps, including iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, Stitcher, and more. And if your provider allows you to, then why not give Culture Wars a rating and a review while you're there? It would really help other listeners to find us. Now, back to the show. I think everyone is sensing what you're describing. So just to sort of try and break this down a little bit more, the idea of the legitimation crisis is what we are seeing all the time in the various attempts by those in authority to tell us that what we know to be true is not true. So I often think that the social justice movement is not offering a critique of society. It's offering an alternative version of reality. It's stopping us from distinguishing between fiction and reality. I think people can see it, for instance, in the way that J.K. Rowling is, we're told she's a transphobic monster, and yet no one can find a single example of anything transphobic she's said. We're told that Jordan Peterson must be a Nazi, even though he spent his entire career warning people about the dangers of Nazism and authoritarianism. Right. We're told that there are 100 genders just because we've decided that there are. We've even got mathematicians now telling us that 2 + 2 = 5. So all of this stuff that I think everyone recognizes, but they don't know how to put their finger on what it's called or what it is or how we deal with it. And I think that's why having a name like the legitimation crisis, that helps, I think. It helps us to tackle it.
That's correct. And if you're not aware of this, look at the last election, for example. In the last election, we have literally, in the United States, we have literally millions of people who don't trust the results of the election on both sides of the issue.
That's right.
And we have legitimation crisis. I mean, look, with the Supreme Court right now, it's been 9 people in the United States. That number is not fixed. It's been that way since 1868. But Congress can shape the size of the court. So you don't like what the court has to say? Well, you just add more people to it. And yes. Harvard's T.H. Chan School was tweeting that 2 + 2 = 5. But you also have like Orban's party in Hungary, Fidesz, I think that's how it's pronounced.
Yep.
You know, when they control the media, so the elections, they're not forcibly rigged, but they're not fair either.
Yes.
So you have many Golden Dawn party in Greece. Like, you have many examples of a lack of trust in public institutions. They're no longer the gatekeepers of knowledge. And I've written about this with the philosophy departments. Of course, my department, I just went up for review. They were not pleased with that. But I've written about this extensively in terms of how philosophy departments as well have failed to be the gatekeepers of reason. And they've fallen prey to what's the moral orthodoxy, which is kind of applied postmodernism, as Helen Jim call it, and the crisis of confidence that causes in traditional institutions. And
yes.
This is a very, very, very serious problem with only a single solution.
And what is that solution?
The solution is absolute unequivocal adherence to the truth.
But that's a problem, isn't it? Because if we have the message constantly pumped out that all that matters is lived experience, all
right.
that matters is your individual perception or the perception of others, and that actually the empirical data doesn't matter anymore. You know, and people are hearing this every day. You know, they are told to attend unconscious bias training
right.
because if you're white, you are complicit in white supremacy. And if you deny that, or if you ask for evidence and that just proves that you're complicit in white supremacy. And when people are faced with this day by day, then I genuinely don't see how you fight back against that, particularly when, as you say, all the major players in politics and in education and higher education are part of it.
It's almost as if you got a bunch of people standing around digging a big hole, and
yeah.
you want the best way to make sure you don't dig a deeper hole is to stop digging. But the people who are digging the hole think it's a moral imperative that they keep digging the hole. Right? So they're morally motivated to continue to dig the hole, and anything that you say is conceived of, like, many people are, they agree that there's a legitimation crisis, but they think that there should be one because the institutions,
yes.
you know, the master's tools cannot disable the master's house. They think that the it's Aubrey Lord's phrase, that the institutions are inherently corrupt, racist, patriarchal, heteronormative, ableist, cis, et cetera, and
yes.
they ought to be disassembled or dismantled. So they're additionally motivated to keep digging.
Well, it doesn't help that the institutions themselves are claiming that they are corrupt. You know,
exactly. The way to solve that is you go, this is what I would love to do. And you go around at a faculty meeting and say, okay, who's racist here? And anyone
yes.
who says they're racist, you fire them.
Well, this is like when Harvard claimed to be systemically racist and the Department of Education said they would investigate them for
Princeton.
That.
Princeton.
Was it?
Yeah.
It was Princeton. Sorry, it was Princeton.
Yeah.
Although I imagine that there have been some figures at Harvard who have said a similar thing.
Well, I'm hearing constantly that these organizations are systemically racist. And you know,
yes.
that was Betsy DeVos who did that. And rest assured, under the Biden administration, you'll be seeing none of that. They'll overturn many of the things. People have a pathological hatred of Betsy DeVos. She did some really, really good things, like put due process back into the system, Title IX investigations. You know, Title IX, this is another conversation, but it's been weaponized. If someone doesn't like you, they just file a Title IX complaint against you. I've had Title
yes.
IX complaints against me, and they make you sign this thing saying that you won't talk about it, the particulars of it. So, and there's no due process in that. There's one person who's a lone investigator.
Just to help the people listening, can you just clarify what Title IX is?
Title IX is an institutional mechanism that the university has when there's been an instance of discrimination, and there are Title VI, Title IX, different types of discrimination, gender
yes.
discrimination, race-based discrimination. And the original impulse for making those federal laws is because there are some people who are discriminated against on the basis of race or sexual orientation, what have you. And those are very, very important that we protect the liberties of those folks.
Of course.
Bruce Gilley at Portland State University published a piece on the case for colonialism. And he's actually, his wife's an attorney. I've gotten to know Bruce quite well. And he didn't sign the initial paperwork that I signed, saying that I couldn't discuss it. But he's actually published all of his Title IX case. And if you don't like, he wrote this piece, The Case for Colonialism, and then the journal editor had quote-unquote credible death threats in the journal.
Right.
If someone doesn't like you or your political stance, they just file a Title IX investigation.
And what this effectively does is, it's not like a concrete case of discrimination or racial discrimination, say, where which is against the law, and obviously you can get the law involved, this is in effect setting up a kangaroo court within higher education, within universities, who require no evidence other than the accusation.
Correct. And so you already have the situation in which there's a political monoculture yes. in the universities. You've already called out all those voices that you don't like. You know, first they came for, but then they came for me, the famous German.
Yes.
So you now have, and just to use as a single example, my university, as far as I know, there's only one person who's openly conservative. And there's one person who's self-described centrist, which is actually Gilly. And virtually everybody else is a radical leftist. And then there's me, who's a liberal.
Right.
Or an identity politics intersectional leftist. So,
right.
But that's not enough for these folks who want absolute dominance and control of the universities.
I think this is very, very dangerous, and it's worth dwelling on a little bit. There was a study here, this was from the Adam Smith Institute in 2017, which showed that less than 12% of academic staff are right-leaning, even though roughly half the population nationally is right-leaning. So what does that do to a culture, to particularly a culture that is all about the production of knowledge? If there is no viewpoint diversity.
So you need to take a step back. And when we were in London together, that was a point of my talk.
Yes.
The Orwellian doublespeak. So you claim to have an inclusive space. Mm-hmm. An inclusive space is a welcoming space. And a space can't be welcoming if it offends people or hurts them, particularly marginalized people or people who have suffered from some kind of historical oppression. So then we have a mandate to scrub the space of any kind of speech that one would find offensive, right?
Right.
So you then, when you have the monoculture in place, you then put in mechanisms that reinforce its dominance. So diversity is another one. Diversity means ideological homogeneity.
Yes, it does. It means the opposite of diversity, in fact.
Yes. So you'll never, for example, see a black conservative, right?
Mm-hmm.
Even in the cases in which those individuals have tenure,
yes,
which is rare, it's very difficult to find a black conservative.
And the ones that do exist are monstered often for being race traitors.
Race traitors, coconuts, various sorts of slander.
Yeah.
So I think that again contributes to the legitimation crisis. You know, James Lindsay said something to me, said, look, even if you had a wand and you could wave the wand and get rid of woke ideology out of the university system entirely. You just extirpate the whole thing.
Yeah.
As long as it's in the university system, the universities are inherently corrupt and the systems of knowledge production are corrupt. And you cannot be economically and internationally competitive with woke ideology. Think about it also like this. Why don't they have diversity requirements for professional football teams?
Oh, you're asking me why?
Yeah.
Why they don't have diversity requirements? Well, because if half of the team is morbidly obese, they won't score any goals.
Exactly. No, that's exactly correct. But it sounds like a stupid question, but it's really important.
Yeah.
Every time you impose an exogenous variable that takes away from winning,
yes.
By definition, you decrease your chances of winning.
Yes.
Every time you have a variable in the academy, for example, that takes away from a meritocracy.
Yeah.
Like including someone's sexual orientation, cis orientation, race into the promotion and hiring practice, you compromise the system of knowledge production.
Well, particularly because this is about ideas. This isn't a...
Yeah. And anytime you have someone like me who, and I think it's the first time I've said this. So I was recently denied promotion, which is very interesting.
Right.
To non-tenure position, non-tenure position to associate professor. I had letters from Dan Dennett, you know, some of the preeminent philosophers in the world, Nick Smith, former head of the American Philosophical Association, and their own letter writers. You know, that's a prophylactic against nepotism and cronyism, is you have people who write the letters that they choose. They said that I should get promotion. But neither here nor there, I don't want to dwell on that. But
yes,
there are mechanisms in the institution to punish people if you don't like their speech. But you can still allow them to say, kind of like the Viktor Orban example I get, you can allow them to say anything they want, but you can make sure that comes at a significant professional cost to them.
That's what I wanted to ask, is that how can it be the case that, just to cite another report, there was a 2020 report by the Policy Exchange that found that one in three conservative scholars self-censor for fear of consequences to their career. Now, what I wanted to ask is, because I think a lot of academics will say, what are you talking about? There's no censorship in universities. You can say whatever you want. But you're talking about these kind of subtle forms of punishment, these sort of retributive mechanisms that operate.
They are retributive, and they're mechanized, and they're weaponized. And I happen to have no problem with fighting. I have an appetite for fighting. I detest injustice in every form. Mm. But remember, the process itself that people go through to receive tenure and get promoted, it cultivates a kind of, not a weakness, but a kind of submission.
Yes.
A kind of bowing down to achieve something, being a good boy, being a good girl, playing by the rules. Well, fuck that. I don't adhere to that one iota. I adhere to a relentless pursuit of what's true. But here's the other thing that's so important for people to remember in this postmodern subjectivist turn, that there has been a turn away from traditional rules of engagement. So, for example, the coin of the realm in academia is if Bruce Gilley publishes, for example, or I'll put it on myself. I publish a piece in Russell Blackford's book, The Problems of Philosophy, and claim that philosophy has not made the progress people think, mm-hmm. or I publish a piece in the Philosopher's Magazine saying that the gatekeepers of reason have fallen and they've held sway to subjectivity, etc. What traditionally would happen is other people would publish responses to those.
Yes.
Like, this is why Boghossian's argument is totally wrong and he just shouldn't be taken seriously. And then that's the coin of the realm. That's how you engage people.
That's the system, right? That's the system.
That was up until very recently, but we've created a monoculture now. And these people are true believers. That's the other thing.
Yeah.
They actually believe this stuff. And that's what's so difficult to try to convince other people who are not in the system. They don't actually believe that. They don't actually want to abolish the police. Then they publish a piece in the New York Times. Yes, we actually want to abolish the police. And they still say, well, they don't actually believe that. But back to the academy, there is a system in place that punishes. They don't play by the same rules of engagement. Mm-hmm. And when you don't do that, you can do all sorts of things to the people who don't ideologically conform.
And what is it about yourself that leads you to just have this kind of fuck you attitude? I'm just going to do whatever I be true to what I believe and also to the truth, actually. Why are there so few scholars and academics who are willing to take that stance?
It's a good question. I'm sure a little bit is a function of university architecture and the way that the disciplines are divided and people get promoted and tenure. Mm-hmm. I think that there is just, and it's going to sound horrible to say, but I really do think that there's just been a callous disregard for the truth. Look, this is not a complicated problem. Mm-hmm. You would use the same tools, literally the same tools, to figure out any kind of alternative medicine or if we've been abducted by aliens. I teach science and pseudoscience. When you want to make a claim about the world,
yes.
Now, I'm not talking about I find something beautiful, a subjective thing, or this piece of music. I'm talking about objective claims about the world.
Yeah.
In Deborah So or Abigail Schreier's book, about you, whatever the claim is, we ought to use the same methods, the same robust epistemologies and methods of inquiry in literally the race and gender and everything else that we do for literally every freaking other thing.
Yeah.
There's no special pleading. There's no special exemptions. And to say that is not only not radical, but it's a duty. Now, people say, well, they respond, well, you're accused of scientism, or Dawkins is accused of this all the time. Mm-hmm. You're relying too much on the scientific method. Well, only if you're making objective claims about reality. I'm not making claims about poetry or, you know, literature, which is your specialty, or Shakespeare. But when you start talking about, was there an actual historical person named Shakespeare? Okay, so
yeah.
You use the same tools with that, with everything else.
Yeah, because it's a matter of fact. It's either right or it's wrong.
That's correct. But we don't have that anymore. We have not only a callous disregard to the truth, but placing politics and a certain brand of identity politics above all else, über alles.
Can you talk us through, or at least explain the extent of that influence? Because I know a lot of people who will say, this idea that the universities are infested with postmodernists is just a right-wing conspiracy theory.
Applied postmodernists. I don't think they're infested with true postmodernists.
That's an important distinction to make, I think. That's fair enough. Because actually, I do think the early postmodernists had some really interesting ideas.
So that's the other problem with this, is that almost all of this stuff, almost all of it has a kernel of truth.
Yeah.
Almost all of it. Like, there's something really profound about systems of race, gender, and oppression. And there have been, you know, on your island, you know, Alan Turing. I mean, there have been grotesque examples of people who have been not only marginalized, but brutalized.
Yeah. Or chemically castrated, as in the case of Alan Turing.
Exactly. Because of who they are.
Yeah.
And Alan Pluckrose does a wonderful job of articulating those, not only those abuses, but the responses to those abuses and what should the responses be? Okay. So before we go to that, so your question was, what is my evidence for the fact?
Well,
that
just I'd like you to address the point that, because I know what people will think, and I'm always trying to anticipate what the counter view is. And I know I've heard people say that this is a conspiracy theory by the alt-right who believe in a kind of what they call cultural Marxism, that there's no basis in truth to this idea that everyone in the universities or the predominant mindsets in the universities are all informed by this postmodern and identity politics.
There's a lot of claims in there, and I'll bracket the Marxist thing because they might largely be correct about that. I don't know the number of Marxists in a university compared to the number of Marxists outside a university.
Yes.
My guess is that it would be higher in the university, but I don't have data for that.
And I think that term has clouded things a lot because there have been anti-Semites who've used the phrase cultural Marxism, you know,
correct.
And so therefore there is a baggage to that phrase that it's, so therefore I think it's probably worth avoiding. But I also know that a lot of people who use the phrase cultural Marxism do not mean it in that way. What they're talking about is the neo-Marxists who took that cultural turn, like the Herbert Marcuse's in the world, the Frankfurt School. That's what they're talking. And those people were real, and they still have influence.
So let's make this really simple.
Yeah.
Let's look at, for example, the Foundation for Individual Rights and Education.
Yes, which is a group called FIRE, which people will know as FIRE.
Right, which is Greg Lucianus' book. He was the first author in The Coddling of the American Mind, which he also cites some great stuff. Pamela Paresky has some statistics on this. My question to those people is, would they agree that, to borrow a term from statistics, the mode of people as an absolute minimum, let's see if we can get a basic agreement on this, are left of center. Now, if they cannot agree on that, then there's really no...
I think they have to agree on that because the data's in on that one.
There's just evidence denialism at that point. Or they have to say, there's something about the method of inquiry that you use that can't lead you to that conclusion. For example, they usually get that from anonymous survey data. Well, we don't trust survey data. Everybody's lying.
Sure.
Okay. So is it more likely that everybody's lying about their political orientation and saying they're on the left when they're actually on the right? And what would be the reason that there'd be this mass lying? I mean, at some point, we have to take the data at face value.
Right. So if we're saying that the evidence is, and it is overwhelming, that there is this kind of ideological homogeneity, overwhelmingly, like you say, left-leaning, that is certainly, I think, undeniable. And I would also point to a lot of the policies and the statements that come out from the university authorities, like the Princeton one that you mentioned, like the fealty to critical race theory, not just coming from academics, but coming from the management and the HR and those sort of bodies. I think these things can be empirically judged.
That is correct. And the types of classes that lean left or lean to identity studies as opposed to lean right. I mean, we have to place some restriction on evidence denialism here, right? Like,
absolutely.
We have to say, and that's a disconfirmation question, or in philosophy, you call it a defeasibility question. What evidence could I present you with that they actually do lean left? Well, there is no evidence. Okay, well, then your belief isn't based on evidence because there must be some data point or some piece of evidence that would come in. So, I mean, we have to, it's just a form of dishonesty. But okay, but let's bracket that. Let's leave it aside and let's say that people say, okay, I'll give it to you. The majority, if not the vast majority of people, are left-leaning.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but now we need to take a look at what that means. So I would argue that they're not just left-leaning. They're left-leaning with an identity lens.
Yes, I agree with this.
They're left-leaning with an intersectional view of reality. They're left-leaning with Henry Giroux's idea coming from also from Paulo Freire, et cetera, teaching to overcome oppression with a critical consciousness, as Freire calls it.
Yep.
They're left-leaning with this idea that teaching is inherently political, the act of teaching is political, and we need to use our classrooms as mechanisms of liberation to liberate people from oppression. So it's not just that they're left-leaning, it's a very particular kind of leaning left that was found in the academy in the academies, but now has seeped out into mainstream consciousness.
Hi, it's Fraser Myers here from Spiked. I produce Culture Wars along with all of Spiked's other podcasts. I hope you're enjoying the show so far. I know it's early days, but if you think this might be a show that's worth supporting, then the best way to do that is to make a donation to Spiked. Even something as little as £5 per month is hugely appreciated and can make an enormous difference to our work. Your donations help us to keep going and growing so we can keep providing you with new, exciting and ambitious content. If you'd like to make a donation, it's really easy. All you need to do is go to spiked-online.com and hit the donate button in the top right corner. That's spiked-online.com and hit the donate button. Now, back to Culture Wars with Andrew Doyle.
So can I make a suggestion then, which is that I think what you're describing is irrefutably the case, and the evidence of our eyes tells us that it's the case. I think what this hinges on is the conspiratorial idea, as in when people talk about the long march through the institutions, which right. which was a thing, and it was a concept that was formulated and attempted, and we know that that's the case. But what happens then is I think people start thinking in terms of, you're suggesting there's this kind of shadowy, deliberate attempt where people get together and say, this is how we're going to manipulate and change the institutions for good. Whereas actually, maybe a lot of this has happened kind of by accident, maybe. And so maybe that undermines this idea that it's a conspiracy. Does that make sense?
So is the claim that we agree that this is happening, but we don't think it's a conspiracy?
Right.
I'd actually agree with that.
That's something I'm suggesting is probably more likely. Yeah. And even though, as I say, the long march to the institutions is not a deniable thing, that was an idea that was put forward. But I don't think it's really happened as such. I think people have fallen into this identitarian way of thinking, largely due to fashion and largely due to the way that that's just the way things have gone, you know?
It's the Overton window.
Right.
The Overton window has shifted. So I would agree with them that I don't think it's a conspiracy. Mm-hmm. I guess there could be certainly elements of people who are conspiring to institutionalize these ideas. I think that they're very honest and very straightforward about what they want to do. For example, equity statements that they want folks to sign.
And yes,
it's my understanding that they just put the word equity in my department's mission. I was the only one on the faculty, I think, who voted against that.
Right.
So they were asking people to sign diversity statements at many institutions. Just to be crystal clear, I have absolutely no problem whatsoever. In fact, I think it would be very beneficial for me to write a diversity statement.
Right.
My problem is not with writing a diversity statement. My problem is with signing somebody else's diversity statement. So I don't think that this is a conspiracy. People are very straight university presidents. For example, president of my own university, he sends out emails constantly about what they're going to do for equity, how the institution must be geared to root out systemic racism. They're very straightforward about this. So I would agree that while there could be some people who are conspiring, this is done in broad daylight.
I think that's it. And I think I'd even go so far as to suggest that calling it a conspiracy theory is a kind of conspiracy theory.
Right.
Insofar as they just say it. It's all out in the open.
So what is their problem with this then?
I think their problem is that the accusation of conspiratorialism is just a means to undermine it, a means to reject the truth of what we're seeing happening to the institutions. I think that's what I mean. The example you just gave of equity is very revealing because, of course, they talk about equity, not equality.
So I was going to write something explaining in plain English what the difference between equity and equality is and why equality of opportunity is vital and indispensable for civil societies, but equality of outcome is actually a deranged mindset that throws us back, I don't even know how many years. And I actually, to bring him up again, I actually asked James Lindsay, I said, dude, I think I'm going to do this. He's like, what could you possibly write that hasn't been written about 10,000 times before? It's a no-go. But I think it's really worth talking about because there seems to be an unbelievable amount of confusion between the word equality and equity and equality of outcome and equality of opportunity, if you want to talk about it.
Well, I'd love you to just briefly outline what that is so that people who are listening understand exactly what you're saying here, because I think people aren't familiar with the term equity and it slips in to the discourse and it sounds great because isn't it the same as equality? Isn't it fairness? And who wouldn't be for fairness? So it's not that, is it? It's about equality of outcome. It's about everyone ending up with exactly the same.
That is correct. So equity is different from equality, and the social justice literature takes great pains to disambiguate those two things. So equality means that person A and person B are treated equally. Equity has a very different meaning. It means adjusting shares in order to make person A and person B equal.
Right.
So equity is a kind of social communism, in a sense.
And yet it can be dressed up to look very sweet and cuddly. I'm thinking of the cartoon that Kamala Harris put out on Twitter just before the election. And it was this image of these two people starting out at a different level, but ending up at the top of the hill, and everyone's happy, and it's all smiles and sunflowers and sunbeams.
And I commented on that. I thought that was a really interesting cartoon. So there's a difference between equality of opportunity and equality of outcome. I want to take a brief pause and say, while we talk about this, I would like your listeners to, or as they say in the most polite way, I invite your listeners to think about the fact that I believe that values are rationally derivable. I believe there are good forms and bad forms of moral reasoning. Mm-hmm. So I don't have to impose any of this stuff on people. We can rationally derive reasons for why equality of opportunity is justice and fairness, like on a Rawlsian conception, the American philosopher John Rawls.
Yes.
So many people who subscribe to the Foucauldian notions don't believe these about power, and power knowledge is one word, don't think that their moral values are rationally derivable, but rather it boils down to power and institutions and institutional dominance. So equality of opportunity is giving everybody an equal opportunity in our institutions, in our school systems. For example, Rawls says giving everyone a public education of the first rate.
Yes, which is fair.
Well, that's by definition fair.
Yes.
Right? Now, there are going to be some things you simply can't adjust for. Like, for example, if someone is born with a physical disability, maybe their legs don't work. Okay. Well, you do the best that you can, right? You mandate handicap ramps and handicap parking spaces.
Yes. Like,
you can't fully overcome what Rawls calls the genetic lottery. There's a limit in what you can do, but to the extent that you can do those things, you try to make society as fair as possible.
Sure.
Right?
And that's the liberal view.
It's not just the liberal view. It's rationally derivable.
Yeah.
And I think this is what I'd like to pound home in this conversation.
Yes.
There are reasons for adopting the stance of equality of opportunity.
Yes.
Because you could be in a position, if your enemy assigned you your social place in society, and if you assign your enemy, you would want to create a system so that it wouldn't matter where you fell, because you'd all have equal opportunity.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that's what most people are for, and most people understand that. I think the water gets muddied by the language of equity.
Yes, because it sounds nice. It sounds nice, doesn't equity? It's a positive, has a positive valence to it.
Also, there's the implication, isn't there, that if there is any kind of inequality of outcome, that if you see that through the applied postmodernism lens,
yes.
What that means is someone somewhere has imposed their power onto somebody else.
Okay, pause. This is so important. Any disparity in outcome in a system, if it's a race disparity, has to mean that systemic racism was at play. That's the only reason upon this interpretation. Mm-hmm. All disparities of outcome, particularly in terms of race, have to be due to inherent or intrinsic problems within the system.
Which is taking a conclusion and working backwards.
That's right. That's the Abraham Kennedy's particularly, but Ta-Nehisi Coates secondarily. So equality of outcome, I heard my friend and jiu-jitsu teacher Matt Thornton gave the best example of this in one sentence for why this is wrong. Mm-hmm. If you really wanted equality of outcome, you'd send the worst singers to the best singing schools.
Right, yes.
Right? It's a kind of Harrison Bergeron, Kurt Vonnegut's novel of viewing the problem and conceptualizing it.
Yeah.
Well, that's the other thing that's interesting about this. So university presidents, to bring it back to university, they're constantly pounding this equity drum. And I put a tweet about this recently. Okay, this is verbal behavior. Mm-hmm. They don't actually believe this. They're just pretending. If they actually believe it, if you're a white person and you're in the university system and you're constantly freaking out about equity, we need more equity, resign.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Design and make your way for, okay, if you're a university president, cap your salary $200,000, put the rest of the money in a scholarship for kids from historically marginalized groups. But they don't do that. They're raking in millions of dollars, at least $1 million. It's verbal behavior to appease people. It's a type of insincerity and shut the fuck up.
It's the same here. You know, when you get sort of white members of management boards talking about how we need more diversity, we need more representation,
great, but
they don't resign. Yeah, exactly.
Right. Then I'll believe that you believe it.
Yes.
Then I'll believe that you're sincere. But the problem itself is with, I don't even think people should think in terms of equity. And it may be very soon that I have to sign an equity statement, or that equity is already, as one of my colleagues said when I came up for yet another disciplinary hearing or disciplinary procedure, he said, look, this is not, you have to teach, you know, diversity mandates, et cetera. This is not me. This is the faculty senate.
Yes.
And he's right. It is the faculty senate, and they have declared as a body. And that's also what happens when you have an ideological monoculture. When you have an ecosystem in which competing ideas and voices are just culled from the system, then people increase their confidence. They're even more confident in the deranged ideas that are untethered to reality in the first place. And if I can just say one more thing, which may seem like it's a tangent, but it's not.
Yep.
One of the things Biden wants to do right now is he wants to give loan forgiveness. You know, people are talking about $50,000 for, and he wants to talk about how we can renegotiate the terms of student loans. Okay. What that's going to do is the disciplines that are already untethered to reality are going to be disincentivized to tether themselves to reality.
Mm-hmm.
Why would they want to if they know that they can just keep cranking out nonsense and people are going to take their classes and there's no corrective mechanism there?
Is this really down to a PR problem insofar as, like you say, equity sounds lovely, right? And when you put it in cartoon form, as Kamala Harris did, it looks very sweet and delightful. So the risk then is if you challenge that, people will say, so what are you, some kind of fascist? Do you want to keep people down? Are you, you know what I mean? So that's more the battle that we've got to win, I suppose.
So as long as you don't place truth front and center,
yeah,
you're going to have problems.
Yes.
It's like the horse, what is it, Alice in Wonderland, that rides off furiously in all directions. Truth has to be your true north.
Yes, it does. But this is the question I'm asking.
It has to be your north star. It's like what I asked you before about why there's no diversity requirements for professional sports teams, because winning is the true north.
Yeah.
The moment you take something outside the university, like, oh, diversity, we need to add, you've lost your true north.
But the problem that we're outlining is how can that possibly be redressed when the idea of truth being the benchmark is no longer, well, this goes back to the legitimation crisis. It's no longer supported by those in authority.
That is a phenomenal question. One answer to that is, and I feel like Mike Nana, the documentary filmmaker, said this to me. He said, universities don't realize that right now in this 2020, started around maybe 2016 or so, we're looking at a situation in which old media was looking in the 90s. It's crumbling.
Right.
Right. So maybe a solution to this is not what you want to hear, but it's true. And Helen Pluckrose would be appalled if I said this.
Say it anyway.
I'm going to say it anyway. She taught me how to put tea in the microwave. But maybe a solution to this is that our current institutions, our academies, need to be rethought from the ground up. And we need to develop new institutions that place truth front and center.
Now, this is something I have thought about. You know, I've even been in the position where I've said, I think it's probably too late for the humanities and we're getting there with the sciences,
right?
What with sort of decolonization programs in maths and science, for God's sake.
Exactly. So one, that's the substructure of legitimacy I'm talking about.
Yeah.
You need a substructure of that. So this is a really important thing. So I've spoken about this before. So there's something called research justice. And research justice is citing people in work from traditionally marginalized backgrounds. Mm-hmm. So privileging their citations and citing, for example, fewer white males or fewer straight white males or what have you.
Yeah.
The moment that you do that, not only that's an equity-based initiative. The moment that you do that, imagine self-crippling your engines of knowledge production, literally crippling yourself so that you can't look at the best available data.
Yes.
So the moment that research justice comes into the picture, one of the first things that you have happened is that you are crippling your ability to research certain subjects and to even extend into certain domains of thought.
Yeah.
You are placing a kind of stop sign. It is anti-meritocratic. It is impossible to – you think the Chinese are going to do this?
Yeah.
You think they're going to have a sense of research justice where they're going to – well, you're going to cite the Uyghurs today. No.
Well, because things don't work if you do this. Ultimately, when you're dealing with engineering, say, and you start to prioritize diversity and decolonization, well, then the car won't drive and the plane won't fly, you know?
Correct.
So it has those tangible effects. So what I'm saying is if they're insisting on this stuff, is the solution then just to scrap them and start again? Well, that's what you said.
I'm not advocating that as the solution, but I think all solutions need to be on the table. And my feeling at this point is that the institutions are lost.
Right. Really?
Yeah, I do. Certainly the humanities are lost. You know, tenure complicates that because now you have people who have been idea laundering, and they're not just idea laundering. They're signing, and I do this too. I assign the stuff I do. But I don't assign them in terms of it's true or false, just that they need to know the concepts, right? So they're assigning their pieces, their articles, and their books, et cetera, that have been idea laundered, and they're making sure that they get those right on quizzes and tests, for example, that there are right answers and wrong answers, then that accords with whatever the orthodoxy is, whatever the dominant moral orthodoxy is. We've done this for years now, and we've created an entire generation of students who think that they have knowledge, but they don't. They just have ideas that have been laundered. I think that the universities have been completely lost. I don't think there's anything we can do about it.
And it doesn't even really matter if a lot of this is deliberate or whether it's a kind of accidental thing that's happened. People are now working within a system where that happens. And people are probably idea laundering with good intentions and not even knowing they're doing it.
They all have good intentions. They think it's the right thing to do. And they think they're better people because they do it.
And that makes it harder to address, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's like the guys digging the hole who think that they're digging it for moral reasons. And they got to keep digging. We have a situation in which entire structures of people. We have literally tens of thousands of people digging the hole. And anybody who says, wait a second, we need to consider this hole, they are Nazis, racist, oppressors, whatever. And if somebody who's actually affected by the holes digging, and I guess maybe this is the analogy that breaks down, but you know, a black person or what have you, they say, well, wait a second, let's stop to consider this, then instead of saying, well, yes, this person's subjectivity matters, that's a good thing about not buying into law of contradictions, is that you can just contradict yourself and everybody else all the time. It means literally nothing. Mm-hmm. They call them a traitor, a race traitor, and a coconut.
That's it. So there is a fear that there's a cost that comes to even asking the question. So that's why I mentioned Ralston College particularly.
He's great. Blackwood. I follow him on Twitter.
Yeah. So he set this institution up precisely for this reason. It's specifically a college for the humanities. And I did say this to him recently, is that I think maybe this is what's going to have to happen, is actually that people with the financial means to do it and the right intentions can set up their own private institutions. The danger there is you end up with elitism. But if there's a way to do it where they can be open to everyone, where people who want to learn, where people who want to go to university and leave with knowledge, as opposed to leave with a false version of knowledge, you know, that would be great.
If that's the substructure again, that also relates back to the legitimation crisis. Look, the only reason, for example, Harvard has a tremendous amount of cred for their name. But they have cred for their name because they've been pumping out people doing really good work, mm-hmm. and doing work that tethers itself to reality. Once that stops, the brand will die. It will become tarnished eventually and die.
Yes.
The universities now are in a crisis. There's simply no question about it. There's been erosion of trust and public confidence. I've tried repeatedly. What am I? I'm just one guy. I'm a non-tenure track as lifetime assistant professor at a fourth tier university. So like, what am I going to do about it? I can sound the horn or I can try to raise the alarm, but think about how disincentivizing it is when people see that and they say, well, you know,
yeah.
The magnitude of this problem is so overwhelming. And now here's why it's worse. George Floyd expedited the whole thing. So the death of George Floyd. So we now have people, woke people, for example, in the Southern Poverty Law Center, which we talked about. We have woke people in CNN, in the New York Times. There's a schism in the New York Times, and there's a schism in NPR, National Public Radio. It's like your BBC.
Yeah.
And the consequence of this, I don't know how much time we have left, but we cannot maintain the current structures if nobody has confidence in the institution.
We can't. I mean, the New York Times, I think no one takes the New York Times seriously now,
right,
with recent events. The same thing has happened recently to The Guardian. There's been a major revolt. They basically drove out one of their prominent writers because she dared to have an opinion that people were offended by. And over 300 members of staff signed a letter to try and get her out.
It's happened to Andrew Sullivan. It's happened to Barry Weiss. The list goes on and on. It's the Uberos, the snake that eats its own tail.
Yeah, it's journalism. It's happening in journalism constantly now.
Right. And all of these folks, this came from the academies. We know exactly where it came from.
Right.
We know the cause. And not only are they not going to stop, I always keep saying to myself, maybe it's some kind of weird Pollyanna attitude I have, like, wow, maybe they're going to realize this now. No, and then I get another letter, you know, like, we have this equity initiative. And I'm thinking, like, is nobody going to call, say the emperor has no clothes? Like, is nobody? And again, the answer is yeah, nobody's going
to
do it.
I get so frustrated, Peter, about this, because when I talk to people about the ideology behind wokeness, and they'll say, yeah, but it's just silly students saying silly things. You ignore it and it'll go away and everything will be fine. And that's not how this works. If you ignore it, they keep going and they win. That's unfortunately what happens. So you have to take a stand against it.
Or the system is itself inherently unsustainable. I also believe the United States economic system is just a debt bubble on top of a debt bubble. This is simply unsustainable. I also believe that the legitimation crisis, however you want to phrase it, I do not believe that it is sustainable. How we get out of it, even if you know that placing truth front and center, just an absolute relentless pursuit of the truth, people simply won't do that. Yeah. Part of the problem is that either they think they already have the truth or they're looking at it through the lens of power. So we either need new institutions, we need new ways to think about problems, we need to rethink tenure, we need to let the universities die a death of their own. I mean, look, they're spending literally hundreds of thousands of dollars when they're on equity, diversity, and inclusion czars while they're laying off faculty and staff.
Yeah, I mean, these people earn an awful lot of money. There's a lot of money to be made out of this industry.
Correct. So the question is, I think you would agree that this is simply not sustainable.
Well, it won't be sustainable, I think, when people wake up to the fact that by going to a university, you can come out less well-educated than when you went in.
So let's talk about this, because this is an extremely important concept. This is a very bizarre way to think about the world. Think about it like this. Let's say that your goal is to win a fight.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And you're taught something that is so divorced from reality. Not only could you not win a fight from it, but your likelihood of losing a fight dramatically increases.
Yeah.
Okay. Like every time somebody goes to punch you, you interweave your hands and put one through one leg and one through the other leg.
Okay.
Let's say that you practice that every single day for years. So you are really good at doing that quickly, getting, and then you make different finger motions for when your fingers are interlaced through your legs. You would have been better off not doing that at all than if you started. Okay. The same analogy, it's isomorphic to the university system. You would be better off not going at all than learning ideas and methods of knowing reality that take you away from reality, that remove your corrective mechanism from reality, like standpoint epistemology.
I mean, I'm at the point where I feel that if people just stayed at home and read books, they would be better off at the end of 3 years.
It depends what the books are.
You know, that's true. If it's Robin DiAngelo, maybe not, but you know, there's lots of great stuff.
You're better off not becoming good, spending no time at all on a process that doesn't work, but you think that it does. Because then you also have the false confidence. And that's what's happening in our institutions wholesale now. People are learning ideas about reality from methods like autoethnographies, methods that simply are action research. These are not legitimate methods of inquiry if you want to make objective claims about the world. But yet they think they have knowledge. And people who think they have knowledge are very dangerous when coupled with these ideologically motivated moral communities.
maybe it's about the attitude as to why you go to university, is that you go to learn and you go to expose yourself to new ideas.
No, but they don't.
No, they don't do that. But I think they go along with it because they see university actually as just a means to an end to get a job. I think they see this as a business more than anything.
I think I have to disagree largely, though not exclusively, with that. They are trained by people. They go through the K-12 system from people who are indoctrinated themselves.
Yeah.
So people in what's called, in the United States at least, pre-service, I used to teach in this system, pre-service colleges of education. So people who want to teach teachers, you can't just walk into a school, you have to get certified.
Yes.
All of those people are indoctrinated in this. So the teachers in the schools are indoctrinated in this, and they're taught from Henry Giroux's idea right on that the purpose of education is to remediate oppression.
Yeah.
And then they're going to school, and then the professors are taught that, and then they teach the kids who have already been indoctrinated into K-12 systems. So I think it's less about finding a job. It's like the meritocracy in sports again. The whole shift of the purpose of the institution, it's no longer book 7 from Plato's Republic of knowledge, you know, education, educare, to lead one out of the cave, right?
Yeah.
When Socrates is talking about the cave and the allegory of the cave in the book 7 of the Republic, it's like there are degrees. He walks out of the cave, and then what's the first thing that happens? And there are degrees of light. You see the light.
Yeah.
You know, what do? You put your hands up, your pupils dilate, and then he eventually goes back into the cave. But the idea is you're not taking somebody out of a state of ignorance. In this case, you're putting something in. You're changing the mission to look at it through the lens of grievance and oppression.
So the question then is, how do we communicate this idea to people that actually by investing all your time and energy in these degrees, you are effectively learning a skill that is futile?
It's worse than futile. Again, it's worse than futile. It's taking you away from reality. You're doing an injustice to yourself.
I mean, I suppose I'm asking quite a practical question here insofar as how can you do that, particularly when the social justice ideology is now targeting school. I'm not talking about university. I'm talking right. about people between primary school, secondary school, what you'd call high school. And, you know, now that that is happening, now that, for yes. instance, critical race theory is finding its way
right.
into schools, we have educational bodies in this country who are supplying resources and materials to primary and secondary schools, to young kids, which is talking about white privilege and all the tropes of critical race theory.
I have an answer for you.
Go on then.
You're not going to like it, but I'm going to tell you.
Okay.
Wait until you see what I'm going to do in 2021.
Okay. That sounds like a threat.
Wait. But not to you.
Not to me. That's all right then. Are you able to tell us what it is?
No.
Okay. Fine. That's fine. That's like a cliffhanger. That's nice. I can't wait.
Is there anything else that I didn't cover that we should have covered? You want to chat about?
I think one thing I should probably ask about, obviously now we've had the election, now Biden is in power, and one of the first things that Biden's team announced is that they would be revoking the executive order, Trump's executive order about critical race theory being right. taught in federal departments. So that would indicate, I know that obviously Biden got as far as he did because he was perceived as the centrist, non-woke candidate. You know, he wasn't Elizabeth Warren, right? And in fact, Kamala Harris dropped out of the primaries early because she did so badly, because right. that kind of mindset just isn't popular with the electorate. And yet, one of the first announcements they make is about revoking this executive order. And of course, critical race theory is a major part of the problem, because critical race theory advances a view of reality that is not tethered to the facts.
Correct.
So if he is willing to do that so quickly, now maybe that's just a glitch, but what do you think, you know, where are we now? In other words, now given the political situation and how, as you've already outlined, the legitimation crisis does in fact relate to that, because no one who loses believes in the results. And that goes both ways, because for the Correct. Past 4 years, we've had Democrats denying that Trump is the legitimate president.
So we have a tradition largely in this country that we give the incoming president the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what I'm going to do for Biden. I think you're absolutely correct. Biden is in no way a radical. The people around him might be radicals. We'll soon find out. But no matter who it would be coming into office, I think we should really wish them the best. I think we should, because, you know, first and yeah. foremost, we are Americans. And I think it's really important to adopt a posture or a stance of, let's hope that things go well and that he does the right thing. And when he does, we'll support him. And
yes.
when he doesn't, we'll call those things out. But when someone's not even in office yet to start criticizing their policies, it's just, I think it's a very un-American thing to do personally.
I think that's a very sound message to end on. Thank you, Peter. This has been fascinating.
Thanks, Andrew. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much for listening. This has been Culture Wars with Andrew Doyle and Peter Boghossian. I'd just like to remind you all to check out Peter's last book, How to Have Impossible Conversations, which he wrote with James Lindsay. It's a really great piece of work and actually very important, particularly at a time when so many people have seemingly forgotten how to talk to each other in a civilized manner. So, do like the show, do subscribe to the show, all the usual stuff, and join us next time when my guest will be the comedian Scott Capurro. See you then.